I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is Business Wise. Our guests today are Kent Wellington, an attorney for Grade Head, and he chairs the board of the Cincinnati Youth Collaborative. We also are joined by Tom Lampe, and Tom is a business development vice president at Messer Construction, and Tom was the chairman for jobs for Cincinnati graduates. Let's talk about this great new merger of two nonprofits.
This has been in the works for about a year now. These are two very strong, vibrant organizations. The Cincinnati Youth Collaborative is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. And Jobs for Cincinnati Graduates is celebrating its 30th anniversary. So we really think this is a merger of two powerful organizations.
Maybe you can just briefly tell us the missions of both of those organizations.
I'll speak a little bit about CYC, and Tom can chime in on JCCG. The Cincinnati Youth Collaborative is focused on youth. We have a mentoring and tutoring emphasis. We also have a college access program. What we find is that the kids that run through our programs graduate at 95% success rate. If you look statewide, about 26% of kids are not graduating from high school, which is a pretty staggering statistic when you take into account that only about 40% of people who don't have high school diplomas have jobs.
Jobs for Cincinnati Graduates has a similar statistic that 95% of youth in our program graduate from high school. Jobs for Cincinnati Graduates, it's based on a national model from American graduates. The model is founded on ensuring that students graduate from high school and that they're able to, depending on their career path, go to post-secondary education, go to a life-sustaining career, or go to the military. And what the program does is ensure that they are ready for whatever career path they choose when they graduate from high school. In order to go forward in those paths, the first thing they have to do is graduate from high school, and we ensure that they do that.
So it seems like a perfect marriage. Your organization is very actively involved with CYC and making sure children have the resources and the people around them, the mentors and tutors, to graduate. And then Tom, Jobs for Cincinnati Graduates, then takes those graduates and helps them find meaningful careers.
Absolutely. Jobs for Cincinnati Graduates is an in-school program. We serve primarily Cincinnati public schools. But there are other schools involved in the entire program. They're both strong organizations. We're in growth. We're adding two programs this year.
What age group do you start getting involved with kids?
Typically, JCCG starts at 10th grade. And the majority of students in the program are in the 11th and 12th grade. And then JCCG is something else very unique. They actually follow students in their first year outside of high school to ensure that they're in college, they're succeeding. If they're in their job, they're succeeding there as well.
Let's talk about this from the business side. Why does this make sense for our community now?
I think the reasons are probably somewhat obvious to folks. People who are struggling in school often struggle in life. And we can get people through high school and employed, it's good for them, it's good for the economy, it's good for the community.
The students that are in the program are the youth of the future, and our future is founded on them. And we need them to be successful.
And to the extent of the community business case, obviously, is to the extent you have more people in real jobs helping drive our economic engine here. It's just a win-win all the way around.
Right, we really see this as a business board-driven enterprise. We have a strong board now combining these two organizations. We both looked at each other and said, we need to collaborate. We need to get together.
So if people listening today would like to learn more information, get involved, where can they go to find information now?
You can go to the website, www.cyc.org, or call 513-475-4148.
For Business Wise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're Cooney, Faulkner, and Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is Business Wise. Our guests today are Kent Wellington. Kent is with Grade and Head, and he's also the chair of the Cincinnati Youth Collaborative. And we also have Tom Lampe, who is Business Development Vice President at Messer Construction, and also is the chair of Jobs for Cincinnati Graduates. And maybe, Kent, you can give us an example of some of the things that Cincinnati Youth Collaborative does.
Well, one of the things we have is a Partners in Education program that really gives businesses in town an opportunity to interact with these kids in the schools. We have more than 300 businesses who are partners in education. Take, for example, Luxottica Corporation has a wonderful program with Withrow High School. My firm, Grade and Head, has had a relationship with Washington Park Elementary and now the School for Creative and Performing Arts, which is a regular tutoring program as well. We're heavily volunteer-oriented. And what we need to do is get more business people out of their business offices and into these schools and, you know, hopefully into some of these homes.
And I think, you know, at MESR, we've had a great example of our partnership in education with the Bond Hill School for over 25 years, where we've been tutoring students on a daily basis. We send employees over there, and they volunteer, I should say, to go over there and work with the students. We partner with the school on business issues and planning, advising, you know, if there are infrastructure needs or building needs for their school campus, we're there to help with all those needs as well. In addition, I'd say with Woodward High School, MESR was able to, through JCG, was able to supply construction equipment and materials for their construction technology program that's really helping them create that expertise in construction.
So even small companies can participate, or even individuals, correct?
Sure. We've got a lot of onesie-twosie tutors and mentors. Sometimes we have groups. Some people are more comfortable mentoring and tutoring in groups, and we have girls' clubs and boys' clubs, and there's really something for everyone under the umbrella.
Well, and the tutors don't have to be subject-specific, do they? I mean, it could be math, reading. There's lots of needs.
There is. There's really no special training. The other misconception about the mentoring tutoring is that it is a huge time commitment, and that's just false. What we find is our most effective mentoring relationships are sustained. That is, they go on for a number of years, but it's really just folding kids into activities you're already doing.
Yeah, and we're serving 3,500 total youth from the second grade through high school and beyond, and so there's all kinds of opportunities for whatever age group that an individual feels comfortable with.
And Kent, I know you've personally been a mentor to a young adult for many years.
You know, one of my first is a second-year law student at Michigan State University, and tomorrow we're doing a college visit to Ohio State, and two of my other ones are going to tag along. Mm-hmm. There's no incremental time allotment that I needed to make for them.
These children who are receiving the gift of having an adult volunteer be a tutor or a mentor might be people who may not otherwise have adult role models in their life, who have even attended college or graduated from high school.
Yeah, I think that you really see that. You take for granted those of us who have had the parents who've gone through the process. For some of these kids, it's really in the dark. That's why, you know, the college access program is so important through this new organization.
Yeah, so what we really do is we help the youth identify what their dreams are, because their current environment doesn't allow them to see what the opportunities are. So we help them create their dreams and then help them realize them. And that's what the mentors and the programs are able to do.
We think it's a perfect fit. You know, the culture's the same. The mission is the same. JCG's got a dropout recovery program that fits right in with our early third grade through high school programs as well.
So if, again, folks want to get involved, get engaged, learn more about the programs, how can they do that?
Go to our website, www.cycyouth.org, or call us at 513-475-4148.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Back to school time is right around the corner, and it's a great time for parents to really use back to school as an opportunity to teach financial education.
And really, financial education is a lot about making intelligent choices about how you spend money. And one way to do that is to give your child a budget for not really just school supplies, because that's pretty simple, but also a budget for clothes if they have to buy back to school clothes, so that they can make choices about how much they spend on a particular item.
It's a great time to sit down and spend time with your children. You can use the internet to do some comparison shopping. There's all types of sales that are going on. So the key is just to engage your child in the process, to help them learn to make choices. And the other point is that just because their friend has to buy a pair of jeans that cost $100 doesn't mean that they have to have the same exact type of jeans.
It's an easy way to introduce budgeting without saying that word budget, because nobody wants to hear that or do that. But really, that's what back-to-school shopping is about. You have a budget for X amount of dollars, and you need to fit all the things that you want into that budget.
Which might mean that if you have a backpack or other school items that are still good from last year, keep those. Take those dollars and use them for something that you want this year.
Like clothes, right?
Like clothes. Maybe a new computer. The issue is, how can you help your child become better financially educated by using back-to-school time as the opportunity?
And if there's not enough money in that budget for everything they want, and normally no one ever has enough money in their budget for everything they want, then they have to make choices about selecting what they want, or choices about, if they're old enough, maybe having a job, doing babysitting, you know, whatever it takes to get their own money to make the choices they want.
Yeah, it's interesting to me. I think a child always has more skin in the game. They are much more reluctant to part with the money when they've earned it, when it's theirs, as opposed to spending the parents' money.
I think that goes throughout society. society. I mean, it's easier if you're working in a company to spend the company's money than your money. It's easier to spend the not-for-profit organization's money than your own. It's always easier to spend someone else's money.
And so as parents, I think it's also critical that we set good examples for our children, that we show our children that you can't spend more than you make. They see us having conversations about making choices from a financial point of view.
And to your point, I think even if you have plenty of money or enough more than enough money to get whatever you want to get in terms of school supplies and school clothes, it's still important to impart to your children the need for a budget and the need to make wise financial choices.
And again, during back-to-school time, you have children in middle school, high school. These are children who can certainly understand and begin to understand the concepts of money management. It's a good time to introduce college planning, too. Hopefully you're on the track to save for your child's college. But start talking about college funds and how much money it's going to take to go to college. And if they don't make the best of grades or you're financially you can't afford top schools, what are ways that they can improve their grades? How can they get a part-time job to help supplement the college fund for your family?
Well, the key is planning ahead. So for any large expenditure, if you can plan ahead and figure out how you're going to pay for it, that really is financial planning.
Financial education is certainly about money management, but also, at least in our home, it's about how we can use some of our financial resources to give back. One important message I think that every child needs to understand, though, regardless of what type of financial resources your family has, their self-worth is certainly not the same thing as their net worth. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Tom and I have been on a series of college visits.
We took a college road trip down south with our daughter. Our daughter is going to be in high school next year, and at least my eyes were wide open when I heard some of the costs of colleges in this day and age.
Well, it is very expensive. It's more expensive than we planned for 17 years ago when she was born. But at least we did start planning for that and saving for it. For people who haven't started that planning process for their children, I would recommend they go to a college website. Every one of them now has expected costs. You know what the total cost will be. And you'll probably be unpleasantly surprised by what college you pick. But at least you'll have an idea of what the total cost is. So you can start having some goals in terms of saving to the extent that you intend to help subsidize the education.
Well, I think that's a big point that you just mentioned there because I don't think college is necessarily right of every child. How can you, as a family, get your child engaged in a conversation before they're a senior in high school? How can you start talking about college even when they're younger to let them have some skin in the game?
Well, I think you have to make sure children understand what realistic expectations are, what type of college they can do, what college they can afford, whether they need to try to qualify for a scholarship, whether it be an academic scholarship, a merit scholarship. Maybe you'll be able to receive financial aid, although that's not so easy either.
Well, if your child has their eyes set on a school that may be more expensive than you can afford, if they have enough time to really focus on their grades and think about how they can be involved in other activities so that they can be a better candidate, for example, for a scholarship at a merit-based scholarship at one of these schools, or to have a higher acceptance opportunity than they may otherwise be able to.
For most perspectives, college is really an investment, so you have to look at it like an investment and determine whether the investment is worthwhile. Do you have the talent that it's going to make sense for you to invest X amount of dollars in a particular college? What are you going to get at the end of that?
There's a good rule of thumb that I've recently heard multiple times, and that is you really shouldn't be spending more in college annually than you want your first year's salary to be. So if you think that you're going to get a job for your first salary, $40,000, the annual tuition cost should not be higher than that. And again, that's a big generalization. But that's probably not a bad rule of thumb.
You certainly should be cautious about borrowing the money to do that because you may never be able to pay it back.
That's right. And unfortunately, it's very easy for students to get loans to go to college. And easier oftentimes than it is to get a credit card these days. So clearly it's a conversation that you want to have pretty early in your child's life before they have to make the ultimate decision about which college they're going to attend.
Well, one thing to remember is there are lots affordable options for college. It may not be every option, but there's local options, two-year colleges, and then get a transition to a four-year college. There's lots of pretty cost-effective options for higher education.
And this may not be a popular thing to say either, but not every child may be suitable to go to college. Maybe there are other career choices that your child would be better situated for. I think as a society, we've sort of determined that the success of our children are whether they go to college. But reality is there's lots of great jobs that do not require a four-year degree.
I think some level of post-secondary education could be a community college, some kind of technical training.
Clearly, that I think is critical.
But not every child has to go to a four-year college right out of high school.
For business-wise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is Business Wise. My guest today is Tom Stoll. Tom is the Senior Vice President with Third, and he is in the consumer and the residential mortgage area.
You can't open up a newspaper, turn on the TV, or listen to the radio without hearing discussion about interest rates being at all-time lows and people rushing to their local fifth-thirds to get refinanced, but not everyone is going to be eligible for rates. Well, it has forced me to say that rates are going lower, and because when we saw them at three, it certainly creates headlines, a lot of people are considering what should I do with my mortgage.
The worst thing to do is to do nothing because you don't think you qualify.
There's Freddie and Fannie conventional loans out there that right now are targeted to customers that have not been able to take advantage of these rates because of the equity situation.
If you do think that you qualify for a loan, or you don't know. At what point should you consider refinancing? If your interest rate is over, what percentage should you actually take a hard look?
This is one where what works for your neighbor might not work for you. Even though you might have the same house, you might owe twice as much or half as much as they do. And so the benefit of the interest rate might require a half a percent change in order to make it something that you would consider. For them, owning potentially less, maybe it takes a more dramatic move for interest rates. There has been some good news, hasn't there, since the recent refinancing program that can help folks.
You mentioned that interest rates are 3% or so, all-time lows. Can they go any lower?
People will ask me, should I refinance now or should I wait? And my answer is, I hope they don't go any lower. And the reason I say that is it'll probably take other negative consequences in the economy that otherwise we don't like to see in order to drive rates any lower. Some stabilization that we have seen over the summer so far have actually brought a lot of buyers out to the market.
Let's talk about another act that has just come about. This is the whole idea of the Consumer Financial Bureau raising the compliance bar.
And it's a little bit different look at Mr. Cordray, who we all know from being in the state of Ohio for many years.
Now he's the czar of consumer protection.
He's the head of this federal group. And I personally talked to him, and I believe his motivation is he wants us to take. Would you do this if this was your brother, your sister, or your mother?
So basically, he's putting bankers, commercial real estate, residential bankers in the position of being more than just a financial banker, but also an advisor.
Let's do what we would do in the best interest of.
How far does the government regulation go in putting a banker in the position of advisor, almost predicting someone to determine whether this is a good loan or option for them 5 or 10 years down the road?
Well, we certainly don't want to see some of the products and some of the things that happened in the market just four or five years ago happen again. But do we have the measurements exactly where they should be? That is a wide open debate with a lot of people coming to the table to talk about it.
I'm Crystal Faulkner with Cooney & Faulkner & Stevens, your trusted business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner,
and this is Business Wise.
Today our guest is Tom Stoll. Tom is the Senior Vice President for Fifth Bank. He specializes in the consumer and residential mortgage area.
And Tom, it does seem, at least in my neighborhood,
I'm seeing a lot more sold signs. Are you experiencing the same thing at Third?
Yeah, I often call those green shoots. So just as we welcome springtime, we welcome the summer. With really much better buying activity. And its number one big one is that it's across a broad range from price range to type of property to second homes, and so it's been more of a normal buying season, especially the best one since home buyer tax incentive for first time buyers out there a couple years.
So does that mean we're out of the woods in terms of more foreclosures and that type of thing? From a pure delinquency, those trends seem to be behaving better and improving slightly.
But you have to keep in mind, don't be caught off guard if you see a rise in foreclosure sales because the state's back about a year ago. The issue of robo-signing from some of the mega servicers, they actually stopped their foreclosure process in order to re-inspect what they were doing to be sure it was appropriate for the consumer. Fortunately, Fifth Third Bank, we were compliant, we were doing the process appropriately. And actually gotten some recognition for what we've been able to do to keep people in their homes as far as modifying and keeping loans in place, home buyers in place.
But is what you're saying, because this whole process stopped, we may now see more homes come on the market again that are being foreclosed.
Right, but don't take it as a negative signal to things softening again. But there will be a catch-up period as these start to work their way through the process.
And if you're a homeowner who has an interest rate that's certainly not been financed for a few years, and you can qualify. What type of credit score do you have to have today in this market in order to qualify for a good lower rate?
What we've seen happen over the last couple of years, as we've come out of the issues of 2007, 2008, is almost more of what you would experience when you look for car insurance. Depending on your events, will determine your risk level. And so the method used in mortgage lending is your credit score, that is your rating, so to speak. If you are on the lower end, there will be a premium attached because there's higher risk, similar to what you might experience when you shop for insurance.
So it's not just one item, for example.
No, that's what you have to look at. And then it depends on what your loan to value is. What is your debt ratio? So there's rarely one component that either takes you in or takes you out. But it's going to be that complete picture.
Do you have any top one or two things that you advise customers as they consider shopping for a mortgage?
The one that I would tell you is that there are no stated and no document loans. So the process will require you to document, provide, and describe to a different level of detail that maybe was your experience three, four, five years ago. But we've asked for that consumers to be more documented.
What do bankers do with all those documents that require everybody?
I wonder sometimes, does anybody really look at the stack of paper you have to sign to go about financing? We absolutely do, and I tell you we treat it with high regard and compliant behavior to protect all of your personal.
So it does serve a purpose.
Right, because you got to trust us. If you don't trust us, then you won't do business with us. Do you see any trends coming over the next six to 12 months in the mortgage industry? The ones that I hope to see continue would be the buyer behavior purchases, people reaching out to find out, will that program work for me? Because information, good information is really what's going to work best for all of us.
I'm Crystal Faulkner with Cooney Faulkner Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is Business Wise. My guest today is Lia Hutchison. Lia is an entrepreneur who is in Huntington, West Virginia, and she has a company called The Pottery Place. Your company, The Pottery Place, has been named as one of the 55 good things about the state of West Virginia. I know that you're an accountant. You're actually a numbers person, so I was intrigued by the fact that you're also, obviously, artistic in having The Pottery Place. How did you come about starting The Pottery Place?
Well, Crystal, I wish I could tell you that there's a very glamorous beginning to The Pottery Place. It was really quite simple, a very basic thing for us and our family. We just had traveled, and my girls had seen pottery studios in other towns and just continued to express over the years that they wish that we had one in our town. And I finally decided to take the leap and pursue this endeavor as far as a business to add to our other businesses that we were doing at the time. So it was sort of a family encouragement for my children for just that's the basic thing that they wanted to see one in their town.
You know, when I was driving through Huntington not so long ago, I saw a big
billboards of the Pottery Place and your daughter, I guess, on the billboard. It's just really taken off. You've grown from one location. You now have three, don't you?
I do have three locations, and I credit that to how amazing that this community understood what the concept of what was supposed to be happening in the Pottery Place. They embraced it and they supported it. And because of that support, we've had the opportunity to grow into other markets, you know, neighboring towns, to grow into another market.
You have Ashland, correct, Beckley, and you're now looking for one in Charleston, West Virginia?
Exactly, yes.
So I've been in the Pottery Place, the one down on Pullman Square, right in downtown Huntington, and even I can't draw stick people, but it's something that I can even do because you make it very easy for people to participate and engage.
You know, I like to say that the Pottery Place, there's something for everyone there. I really believe that everyone can make something that they're proud of. And you touched earlier on the fact that I'm a numbers person, which I am. I'm also an accountant, and it's what, you know, it's what I've been trained to do. So prior to this endeavor, I had no idea what a kiln was, no idea what viscosity was, but I was very willing to learn because it's something that interested me. So I pursued it. I went and got training for it, and even now I'm still not that artistic person, but I've learned that with the different tools that we offer in the studio, everyone can do something that they're proud of. They can use transfer paper or dots or whatever, and it's really a joy to see people come and pick up their pieces that they've made and see how nicely they've turned out. It's always rewarding to be there for that event.
And it's so colorful and beautiful, and you mentioned your girls. You have two daughters. It has to be very inspiring for them and very rewarding for you to not only work with them, but for them to watch you and observe you grow this business.
Absolutely. And I'm going to tell you something. They not have only watched and observed, but all of my children, I have two girls and I have two boys, two older boys, each one has contributed something to what's happened with this business. From the very initial stages of even choosing the name, I had like 50 names chosen, and my children, my family, was my sounding board to sort of weed through what we felt like was the appropriate image that we wanted to have for this new venture. And they've helped me every step of the way. My oldest daughter even went to training with me. They still participate producing samples. All of my children have worked with me in the studio, including my boys. So it's definitely been a rewarding experience for the whole family to see that, like you said, from the beginning stages of even name selection and logo presentation to where we are today in our growth. And they still participate in that and sort of, you know, they've been around it from day one. I value their opinions. They've gotten me on Facebook and Twitter and
Your website, before we go, you have a beautiful website. What's your website if folks want to check out The Pottery Place?
It's www.thepotteryplace.biz, B-I-Z.
For Business Wise, I'm Crystal Faulkner. I'm with Cooney Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is Business Wise.
My guest today is Lia Hutchison.
Lia is the president and founder of the Pottery Place that has locations in Huntington, West Virginia,
Beckley, West Virginia,
and Ashland, Kentucky, and soon Charleston, West Virginia.
The Pottery Place has been named as one of the 55 good things by the West Virginia State Journal.
How did that make you feel?
Honestly, Crystal, I was so honored and humbled
whatever they make you feel, the food and name, the 55 good things about what's about, would think that the Pottery Place was one of those. So why do you think that was named one of the 55 good things? I don't know. Well, don't you think that I've been in the Pottery Place? It's just happy people. You have many types of activities and ways people use the place. Maybe you can share a few.
The Pottery Place actually many needs for people. You know, this day and age, it's very difficult to go out and buy all the supplies that they would need to make a handmade kiln. But I think that there's a desire to do that. I think there are enough people out there that enjoy that process of creating something special for someone that they love.
I actually met a child hand for the children. Even as kids grow up, they spend less time and less time in art example, and we as parents don't quit enjoying the things that they make. The hand make, the family come in, and we have a family tradition coming 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 in, and we have a
enjoy this experience.
Why do you think that? We try to make it so that people from all walks of life, from men and dudes, because you have to do this for the consumers' perspective, and in mind all along. Well, let me ask you, you're just a moment, I know you and your husband have had many different businesses in the last really tight type of adventures. So you've been an entrepreneur in 2009, right in the midst of one of the worst recessions we've ever had in our lifetime.
But yet you've been successful. What would you say to someone out there who has an idea, maybe has this calling, but they're just afraid or they don't know how to take the next step to make their dream come true?
When I approached this model, I didn't necessarily have a job, where I felt like if I kept my price point, there were many different ways to produce a product, and I chose the one that I felt was the most customer friendly, the one that would allow my customers to come in and enjoy this experience over and over, because this is entertainment. This is people's extra money. This is extra money that they have to spend. It's not a necessity, obviously, for anyone.
But this is what people do to relax, time with family. And I just made sure that every step of the way, I kept in mind, like I said, that I have four children, and I would want this as my children were younger, and we all came in together, that it's something that we could afford to do. So that's something I very consciously did. I made sure that I didn't price myself out of this market. I made sure that from a business perspective, I kept everything family friendly, family user, and affordable.
Folks, we'd like more information about the Pottery Place. Your website is www.pottery place.biz. For business-wise, I'm Crystal Faulkner, Crystal Faulkner, and Kuni Faulkner, and Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is Business Wise. My guest today is Wayne Gary, Wayne is a partner in Benefit Resources, and Wayne, the health care reform issue is just so complicated, confusing, and very difficult for so many people to understand. But there are some things that people absolutely need to know that's going to have an impact on them this year and in the very near future. One of those is the fact that flexible spending account limitations have all changed. Maybe you can share some of those details.
Beginning in plan year 2013, so this is coming up when you're making your election, that's now limited to $2,500. Some employers have already limited that in the past, so it was up to the employer. But beginning in 2013, $2,500 is the most you'll be able to put into a flexible spending account. However, if your spouse also works and has access to a flexible spending account, they can put $2,500 in also, so you could get $5,000 in total.
And also, the medical deduction is changing as well.
The medical deduction used to be 7.5%, and now that's been increased to 10%.
Now, there is a grandfather for people who are older, but still you have to be able to exceed 10% of your gross income going forward before you can take the first dollar of medical insurance deductions or medical deductions in general.
Both of these things, obviously, are ways to pay for the health care reform.
Beginning in 2013, employers will have to report the cost of health coverage for their employees on W-2s. And I think a lot of people are wondering whether this is taxable.
Yeah, that was a big issue. We've gotten lots of calls on that, where the employees think that's going to be taxed. You can make your own conclusions about what the future holds, but right now, all that is required is for an employer who files 250 or more W-2s. So first, it's not applied to a smaller employer. But if you're at the threshold, maybe you've got 225 employees and you have turnover, you could file more than 250. So if you file more than 250, then you have to put the cost of the plan that the employer pays on the little box in that tax form that you get. W-2. It is not taxed. That is not a taxable item.
Not at least 2013.
Correct.
It may not be unlikely that someday we may be looking at tax on health insurance premiums.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question. And that's just something that happened right now. That's been talked about for years. They've talked about taxing. The money that employers spend on health insurance. It's never been done for obvious reasons, but they've got to find a way to pay for this. And the limit on the flex spending account, the limit on taxable from 7.5 to 10, and whether or not they're going to tax this.
Well, one credit that they did give small employers is a credit to help smaller companies purchase insurance for their employees. That occurred a few years ago.
Yeah, that actually came in 2010. What that is, they face a tax credit up to 35% for the cost of the employer's contribution to provide the health insurance for the employees, up to 25 employees. It's also 25% for small nonprofit organizations. The key there is if you're a small business under 25 people, you should definitely get to your accountant or your tax advisor. It's a formula. I had a small group call us that paid $100,000 in premium and they thought they were going to get a $35,000 tax credit. It goes through a formula. Their tax credit went up to about $3,000. It's still $3,000, but I just want to make sure small businesses don't think they can take 35% of their premium and deduct it. But you should get to your accountant.
If people would like to get in touch with you to find out more information, what's your telephone number?
Telephone number is 513-232-9992.
I'm Crystal Faulkner, your business advocate. I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is Business Wise. My guest today is Wayne Waring, a partner in Benefit Resources, and he's very knowledgeable about the details as it relates to health care reform laws. Wayne, are there any new laws that people need to be aware of that's going to have an impact on them this year, in 2012?
2012 is already in place. The things that went into effect up until now were popular items. Like no annual limits, no overall limits, pre-existing conditions, children can't be applied anymore, adults, children covered in age 26 are covered, those things are already in. 2013, there's a lot going on, there's a limit on the flexible spending account, the $2,500 limit, spouse also works, you could also contribute to her plan, that's $5,000. And the W-2 recording requirements take effect in 2013. That says if they're under 250 W-2s filed, they do not have to comply. If you're over 250, then you have to put the cost of the medical plan on the W-2. That cost is not taxed. 2014 is when everything is going to go into play. Provided that there were two big items to cover. One was the Supreme Court ruling, they've already ruled on that. So it made the individual mandate constitutional as a tax. And then also in November, there's a thing called the election, which could obviously change the landscape.
And 2014 is when the exchange of the insurances come into play.
Yeah, that's when the exchanges come into play, a lot of the penalties and taxes come into play. 2014 is when a lot of the things that for obvious reasons they didn't want to go into effect prior to 2012. That's when all of those things are going to go into play. Those things could change, and we're really advising our employers. Let's take it a step at a time. Let's do the things. 2013, that's going to happen. Whatever's going to happen in 2013 is going to happen. But there's not a lot of usefulness to sit down. There's usefulness to strategize about 2014. But in terms of what's this going to cost, penalties and so forth,
I don't know that I'd get too deep in the woods on that because that could all change.
What kind of advice do you have for people as they age and dealing with the Medicare issues?
Well, the one thing in the healthcare reform law that affects seniors is what's called the donut hole. What that is approximately, if you spend about $2,850 on drugs, there's copays up to that, like you're used to with your group plan. There's a big gap, which is what they call the donut hole, between there and about $4,800, and you pay the entire cost. So what the healthcare reform law did is began to give give a 50% discount on brand name drugs in the donut hole in 2011.
It continues between now and 2020.
You'll continue to get help, and as that decreases in 2020,
there will be no donut hole.
So when you have Medicare, many people have the supplement,
but then the prescriptions is something completely separate.
Right, you have Medicare A, which is basically hospital, Medicare B, which is doctors,
Medicare C, which is Medicare Advantage, which is a combination of all of that, including drugs.
And then Part D is drugs.
So when you have A and B, you need to buy a Medicare supplement,
and you need to buy a prescription drug plan called Part D.
And if folks do want to reach out to you, what's your telephone number?
Telephone number is 513-232-9992.
For Business Wise, I'm Crystal Faulkner. I'm with Kuni Stevens, your business advocate.